Welcome to Dr. Ruscio Radio, providing practical and science-based solutions to feeling your best. To stay up to date on the latest topics, as well as all of our prior episodes, please make sure to subscribe in your podcast player. For weekly updates, visit drruscio.com. That's drruscio.com. The following discussion is for educational purposes only and is not intended to diagnose or treat any disease. Please do not apply any of this information without first speaking to your doctor. Now, let's head to the show.
Hi, everyone. Today, I speak with Daniel DeBon about EMF, radiation, cell phone exposure, something that we've discussed on the podcast in the past. And I feel as if when we do subsequent interviews, they get better and better each time, because this interview really did lay out a good explanation as to what you have to avoid and reasonable ways to avoid it. My concern here, which I do share in the podcast, is that some who have taken up the mantle of educating people on the dangers of excessive exposure may have gone a bit over the deep end with how rigorous we have to be in our mitigation and or our avoidance. And I thought Dan really, as a scientist, did an excellent job of towing that line that will reduce your exposure to some of the documented negative health effects to male sperm, female fertility, neurological health, ontological health amongst others, but also not tipping you over to fear and kind of recommendations that are almost impossible to adhere to. So a great conversation with him today, and I hope you will enjoy it. And if so, please head over to iTunes and give the podcast a review. Okay, here we go to the show. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Dr. Ruscio Radio. This is Dr. Ruscio. Today, I'm here with Daniel DeBon, and we will be discussing the world of EMF exposure, dirty electricity, pollution from EMFs, which can be a challenging topic to get a non-biased read on. But Dan's got a pretty interesting background, and I think he's going to be able to give us a good even-handed narrative here. So Dan, I'm really looking forward to digging in on this topic, and welcome to the show.
Dr. Ruscio, thanks so much for inviting me. I really appreciate it. I look forward to chatting with your listening audience. So thanks again for inviting me.
Absolutely. And you know, we were just talking offline and you were giving me some of the backstory, which I think we should start there, because you kind of started into this field with a bit of skepticism, which to me is refreshing, because it's always important to challenge views, because unfortunately in natural medicine, it does seem that a lot of opinions are based upon a priori assumptions, and there's not a good scrutinization back to science to make sure that we're kind of cultivating out of our recommendations things that are, devoid of any kind of scientific mooring. So I really appreciated that offline. So why don't we just start with kind of your background and how you got into this field, and then we can go from there.
So Mike, probably for 30 some odd years, I participated and actually ran organizations that developed standards for telecommunications technologies. And so my role in life was to define what a technology piece of equipment should do. And then I had another division that actually tested to see if those standards were compliant with the technologies we looked at from the various vendors. So I had a rich history in scientific background, and I was very precise in how I evaluated that technology. So fast forward about 10 years or so ago, I had my sons visiting, and they were adult men, and they were using their laptops 3 or 4 hours at a time. And my wife walks by, and she's a social worker, right? So she says, that technology on your lap can't be good, and I want grandchildren. That's what she said to them. So I thought about it for a second. I said, there's no way the power levels that were emitting from that technology could any way influence a cell. That was my opinion at that time. But I said, because my scientific background and my research work, I decided, well, let me go take a quick look. And believe it or not, Mike, at that time, we knew that after 3 or 4 hours of exposure from a laptop, that the male sperm was over 20, 25% immobile. So there was clearly, we knew from multiple data studies that there was an influence when a male put a laptop in on their lap. And literally that's what started me. I began the journey of trying to understand the physics and its influence, the physics of a radiation to the biology of the body. So that's where I started.
And I've heard that in Asia, it's fairly common for both women and men to wear kind of EMF shielding garments, and probably in part for the reason that you cited there. Do you want to talk more about some of the most deleterious impacts that EMF and like exposure have on the human body?
I will. But let me reinforce something. It was interesting you say that, because I created a shielding device for my sons that actually shielded both the radio frequency, the RF, as well as the extremely low frequency, the ELF, they call it. It's much lower rates. And I built them, and we began selling them to the community. Believe it or not, we were selling them to Europe before we were selling in the U.S. It was ironic. It's like, give me a break. So it was, you're right, Mike. There were different understandings of it, depending on what part of the world you're in. And in the U.S., we seem to be behind many others that seem to have had a better understanding than we do. So, given I said that, we talk about what we now know from a plethora of research, thousands and thousands of well-documented scientific research that talks about what the impact could be to the body, the cells itself. And in general, the laundry list begins with, we know there's neurological impacts. When you have a cell phone to your head, you got a signal going through towards the brain. And we're going to talk a little bit about more about what the sciences of this is, but it goes into the brain. It goes particularly into the very soft tissue of the frontal lobe. So when I say there's neurological impacts, your mood changes. We have research that talks about that kind of level impact. So that's the starting point, which, by the way, I consider pretty important in most of this laundry list. Sure. Physiological changes. There's tingling in your hands, potentially, if you're hypersensitive particularly. Your eyes hurt. Maybe you have tendonitis, possibly headaches. You may have nausea, insomnia, headaches and pains, fatigue, dizziness, nausea. You may be depressed, the neurological. Burning sensations. Actually, it's a microwave signal. So when you feel burning, it is literally the start of a microwave signal and what it does to the body. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. But then there's allergy-like symptoms. There's concussion-like systems, believe it or not. And then, of course, as at the starting point, we talked about infertility. There is known cancer-causing impacts, and there's some very, very large study work on that we can talk about. And there's many other chronic illnesses. So it's a plethora of stuff going on when you have exposures to this electromagnetic radiation in our lives. And the sources, by the way, are the laptop, the tablet, the cell phone. And if you think about it, Mike, all of these kinds of devices really have only been in our lives over the last 10 years or so. Before that, I had a cell phone when they first came out. I had no one to call because none of my friends had cell phones. Now, of course, at 6 years old, you're given a cell phone and you're calling your grandma from it. So the use of this technology and our environment and how it may be influenced our body, even over the last 10 years, has fundamentally changed.
Let's talk about the evidence that supports this. I think most people understand that there can be an impact, but they question, as you had questioned way back when, is the amplitude, the duration, the intensity enough to cause any type of ill effect? And we've had guests on the podcast in the past that have said, yes, it is. But I think for those who are sitting on the fence or skeptical, you know, hearing about what has been documented is really helpful to kind of sway them. So let's go into what some of the better evidence here has found.
Okay. So in the world of medical study, as in the world of electronics, by the way, when you evaluate something and then you standardize on it, saying that I just tested it and it looks like this, there's a certain confidence level you have of what you're stating. So in the past, 5 years or further out, most of the studies had populations of 50, 100, 200, 500 participants. So when they would find a result, it wasn't statistically significant. To be statistically significant, you have the need for very, very broad population sizes. So we have all these studies that were done, but none of them were statistically significant. Now, as a side note, if you look at the metadata, which is the data of all of these studies, it's overwhelming evidence. But individual studies themselves were not statistically significant. And then about 7-8 years ago, the National Toxicity Program, which is a part of the federal government, they funded like a $25,000 study, epidemiology study, and they took very large populations and they exposed very large populations. And then they had those who weren't exposed. And then because the populations were so broad, they were able to say at the end of the study, look, this is what we found, and it's statistically significant. So the National Toxicity Program actually was intended to sort of dispel the linkage between a cell phone and frontal lobe cancer. Ironically, it came out and it pointed out that there's a statistically significant increase of exposed populations. So all of a sudden, we now had epidemiology study that showed a direct correlation in a closed environment that showed a direct link. And then after that, there was a Ramazzani study out of Italy. Ramazzani is an institute that brings together researchers and scientists, and they collaborate in Europe. And the Ramazzani Institute did somewhat an identical research study with statistical samples that were broad enough. And believe it or not, they found the same statistical significance. What I didn't mention, it was not only the frontal lobe, but it was the heart. And a lot of us were surprised about that. But Mike, as you know, the frontal lobe is very, very soft tissue, and so is the heart. So it wasn't terribly surprising. So now we have very large epidemiology studies that are clear and evident. And then you look at literally the thousands and thousands of research study work that's been done. And it's very, very specific stuff that's going on. And they look, it's well documented, it's well written, it's well executed. And there is clear evidence that some would say eliminates all doubt. And then, of course, on the other side of the fence, Mike, we have those who don't think there's any evidence at all. You know, it's funny. I was reading an article by a biochemist, and this individual said there was no link. And I'm thinking to myself, you as a biochemist for sure should understand that there's clear evidence. Whether it is significant enough for you to agree or not is another discussion, but there is certainly evidence that's been done in research that shows those links.
Well, I can clearly appreciate what you're saying. Just to give the audience a quick example, which they may or may not have come across, 60 Minutes recently did an expose on probiotics,
and they interviewed a few experts. And one of the experts, I believe her name was Dr. Patricia Hubbard, although I may have her name slightly off, professor of medicine at some major university. And when asked if there was any evidence showing that probiotics can help with IBS, she said no. Now, to your point and kind of the parallel analogy here, I would consider handfuls of meta-analyses, even some meta-analyses of 23 clinical trials that consolidated to only the highest quality clinical trials, concluding that probiotics can help IBS. I would state that it's pretty darn hard to understand how she would comment there is no evidence when this is the gold standard level of scientific evidence proving something. Now, perhaps she'd like to see larger clinical trials, more of them, or perhaps yes, because researchers haven't agreed on, well, this is the one strain or species or combination of that are the best. But to say that there is no evidence is clearly either misinformed or just biased or intellectually dishonest. So I can fully appreciate the point you're making here, where if someone has a very, very high level of evidence they need before they make a recommendation, perhaps they could make that claim that there's not adequate evidence. My retort would be, we are doing more harm to people than anything else if we're telling those with IBS there's no evidence that probiotics can help them, because clearly there has been, and perhaps there are some risks associated with probiotics, but they are infinitesimally small when compared to the benefit that one can gain from them. This seems to potentially be a parallel. And when Dr. Joe Mercola was on the podcast, he did mention the National Toxicity Program, as well as a Ramazzini paper. Now, my next question was going to be, what would the common criticisms of those papers be? And what you're saying is there is evidence showing detriment, but depending on how perfect the data set needs to be to sway someone's opinion, one may look at this data with a different conclusion. Is that fair?
There's no question about it. You can question the transmitter relative to the subject and its impact. The length of that could change the results. But what was interesting about the NTP, was that these guys were smart. What I didn't talk about is there's standards for cell phone transmissions. The FCC defines 1.6 watts per kilogram as being the maximum power level of a signal. And with that, it allows a signal to penetrate a 6-foot male by 2 inches into the skull and heat up by as much as 2 degrees. So what do I mean by that? Well, a cell phone uses roughly 1 to 2 gigahertz signal, and a microwave is 1.3 gigahertz, and they're basically the same signal. And guess what? When you put a piece of meat into a microwave oven, the water between the cells heat up and oscillate, and it cooks the meat. So now you're talking about an equivalent but much lower power level heating up the body by 2 degrees. These guys who did the NTP were smart enough to say, I'm going to take the signal and move it far enough away that all I see is biological. So these guys were really smart. And by the way, the standard that I just mentioned was quite a number of years old, over 20 years old. And it was based on a model of a 6-foot male in the Army, by the way. And that roughly represents about 3% of the population. Today, people using cell phones are women, children, smaller men, not 6 foot. And the variation is maybe why some think that the standards are not accurately protecting us.
Hi, everyone. I want to thank Doctors Data, who helped to make this podcast possible, and who I'm very excited to say has now released a profile called the GI360, which is finally a validated microbiota mapping measure. If you remember back, I've discussed numerous times the only lab that is really validating a mapping of the microbiota to have clinical significance is the GA map out of Norway. Well, turns out that Doctors Data is not only using the same methodology, but also in collaboration with this group in Norway, using their parameters to adjust what we call normal, abnormal, or dysbiotic and normal. So great news, we finally have a validated measure. Now, this test also offers, in addition to the microbiota dysbiosis index, they also offer PCR assessment for bacteria, virus, and pathogens, a comprehensive microscopy for parasites, a Melitoff bacteria in yeast culture. And as you would imagine, because of the rigorous validation they've gone through, they also have approval from the CE, which is equivalent to the European FDA. So great test. Please check them out. Doctors Data is offering 50% off a practitioner's first GI 360 test kit. Go to drsdata.com/RUSCIO, to claim your first kit. Limit one per provider, and the offer ends October 31st, 2020.
So let's talk about some of the practical aspects of top sources and how one can continue to use these devices, because of course there's a lot of drawbacks to, you know, going into a cabin in the woods and totally unplugging, as appealing as that sounds sometimes. What's a reasonable way to use a cell phone, use a laptop, to have Wi-Fi in your apartment, but kind of mitigate the exposure and find that middle ground? Because I think that's the thing that people are really trying to find the best way to continue to use these devices, have the advancements that we have with access to the internet and everything else, but not do it in such a way that they're posing harm.
Mike, you know, it's a great question, because in the law of physics, the signal levels that start quickly drop off in power levels. And so when we start talking about things you can do
with distance, you mean, right? They drop off. With
distance is your friend, right?
Yeah.
After 1 to 2 feet, if you use a cell phone to the head, that's the maximum amount of power level that's entering into your skull. If you go 1 to 2 feet away from there, 80% of that danger is gone, believe it or not. By 4 feet, 98%. So one of the most very simple things to do is keep distance from your device, because that power that could be damaging to the cell has less capacity to do that the farther away you are. If you put a cell phone to your head and you used it for 3 minutes a day, there would likely be never a biological impact to your head. In other words, duration, the time of the exposure, is something you watch for as well. So if you want to be more protected, simply by using shorter durations of time when you're using technology, you certainly reduce the potential exposures to your body.
Now, with laptops, so right now as we're speaking, I am seated / standing at a desk, and it's a wooden desk, and I have a laptop on the top of the desk. Now, I do have an EMF kind of platform shield where, let's say I'm sitting on a chair or sitting on my couch, yep, and I'm in my lap, I will use the shield then. Do I need to be using a shield as I have my computer on a small laptop stand on top of my wooden desk, or is that enough distance there to protect me?
You're enough distance to protect you. You know, you're not going to panic about this. In fact, like you, I have a laptop as my primary computer, and I have it connected to a monitor, and I have the keyboard connected to the laptop. Why do I do that? Because I'm taking all of the electronics and I'm moving it away by more than 2 feet. And so I'm a very little exposure. And to even further that, I have it on Ethernet. I rather than using a Wi-Fi close to me, I have it connected by an Ethernet cable, and that Ethernet goes to my Wi-Fi. So very simple things you can do with a Wi-Fi, by the way, you know, like so long as it's more than 10 foot away from you, you're pretty safe. I wouldn't worry about it at all. But I can tell you, I'm pretty conservative about it. So I have a timer, a $10 timer on my Wi-Fi, and I have it in the farthest place I can in my house. So when it's being used, I'm very, very far away from it. But at night, I turn it off with a little timer.
Sure.
So there's a general rule of thumb, Mike. You think about the transmitters that potentially can be impacting you, and you turn them off if you don't need them. I call that bees in the room. With your cell phone, when you have a cell phone in your hand, you have a Bluetooth transmitter on there, you have a Wi-Fi transmitter on there, and you have a cell phone transmitter on there. I don't use a Bluetooth or a Wi-Fi, so why do I need them on? In other words, I'm going from three bees to one bee. One bee will kill, will be fine. 1,000 will kill you. And so the idea is simply trying to find where you have in your house these bees, where they're transmitting, turn them off, and that very action reduces exposures and minimizes the potential impact to your body.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, just commonsensical.
Yeah, very, very. Hey, Mike, if you have a new meter on your house, right, and it's on your garage door, on the side of your garage, and then you have your kitchen first and then a bedroom next to that, why would you panic? The signal's 20 foot away, 30 foot away.
Right.
There's literally zero danger because those transmitters are far enough away where they don't pose a danger. Mm-hmm. Now, if this meter was sitting on your bedroom and the outside wall, I'd say move the bed, move the bedroom, because that's eight hours of exposure at night that you want to try to avoid. And when your headboard is directly against the meter itself, that's the higher power level. But by putting it on the side of the room, 10 foot, 15 foot away, you really substantially reduce. So
what meter?
Smart meter.
Electric. Gotcha.
Okay. Yeah, the smart meters. Yeah. A lot of people panic about these kinds of things, and there's literally nothing to panic about. This is physics. It's not magic. By simply keeping your distance, you really are fairly safe.
Now, you had mentioned Bluetooth, and so a couple of questions for you here. A couple of them are my own selfishly motivated questions, but I have a kind of silver-lined cell phone case. So when I'm taking a call, typically when I have some kind of call where I don't have to be at my desk, I'll walk outside. So for our audience, this is getting movement, which we need to make sure not to be anchored to our desk all the time, and it's getting sun exposure. So it's a good health practice. But I kind of have to keep the phone on me, obviously.
Yep.
So I'll put the cell phone in the silver lined case and either put that in my pocket or hold that in my hand. But I am using a Bluetooth device, and I do have concerns about that. I've tried the EMF reducing headphones, but sometimes they're a little bit kludgy, and you know, I need to either be convinced that it's worthwhile for me to use the Bluetooth or not use a Bluetooth device if I'm going to be on a 30, 40 minute, hour long call, or if maybe there's not enough exposure there for me to have to be concerned.
So, Mike, there was a study probably 20 years ago on a Bluetooth signal. And it was looking to see if there was any correlation to damage to the frontal lobe cells from a cell phone. As I mentioned before, cell phone is 1.6 watts per kilogram. That's not a lot of power, but it's enough. Your Bluetooth transmitter is about 3 watts. You know, that's five times less the power level. Well, in this research study that was run, what they found was 0.1 watts could mutate the frontal lobe cell if you were concussed. In other words, your blood-brain barrier is down. and it, you didn't quite have the defenses that you would normally have, dot 1 watts per kilogram can impact the cell, the frontal lobe cell. So I don't like Bluetooth stuff for that reason, because I know there's been some fairly well executed studies that show very, very low levels can impact the frontal lobe.
What are your thoughts there? I mean, that's somewhat in a disease model. And I totally appreciate the point that you're making, that if damage was shown in a post-concussed model, you know, long enough exposure of damage could or exposure could lead to damage. Is that kind of
Yeah, that's exactly. In other words, if you're damaged already, it can get you're more susceptible.
Well, I'm all sorts of screwed up, so that's probably a safe right. bet.
Well, look, 30-40% of us have a concussion and never knew it, right, Mike?
Right. So I'm assuming you feel the same way about Bluetooth mouses. And before you answer, let me just throw in a test I did with I have an EMF device here. And I was actually shocked that my Bluetooth wireless mouse threw out a ton of signal. And ever since then, I now, even if I'm going to a coffee shop, I just bring a wired mouse and plug it in,
right,
because the meter reading I got was off the charts for that.
Yeah. Mike, remember what I said, remove the bees in the room if you can. And a mouse is a transmitting source. Worse than that, it's in your hand and it's close to your body and it's within 1 or 2 foot, even though 80% is safe. Why would you increase the potential risk if you don't need to? Just plug it in and you're fine. Yeah, Everything works.
I think, if I'm being honest, I've changed over my mouse, but I still have a wireless keyboard, which is probably stupid for me to have, because it's at this stand at my laptop that doesn't go anywhere. I'm not mobile, so I don't need the convenience of mobility. So I'm going to go on Amazon after this and get a wired keyboard just to make sure I take
Mike, I had a person call me, and he's electro hypersensitive, and hopefully we'll talk a little bit more about what that means. But he is electro hypersensitive. In other words, he couldn't put anything close to him without feeling ill in some way. And I told him, well, let's try to have a workstation to minimize, your exposures. So I had him get a modern monitor. The emissions from a modern monitor are very low. I had him push it a foot and a half away, put a big letterhead on it, and I had him get a keyboard, plug it into the router, into the laptop, a mouse with a wire, and have an Ethernet. So he calls me up and he says, I'm still in trouble. Something's really wrong. What you told me did not work. And I said, all right, let's look at your laptop. He didn't turn the mouse or the Bluetooth signal off. He was actually feeling that. So it is really important in general sort of to minimize exposures, to take simple precautionary measures. But for your hypersensitive, it's definitely important for you, because in time it gets worse if you don't try to handle it now.
And let's go into that topic of hypersensitive individuals. This is one thing on the podcast we've discussed before. I believe it was with Heidi Turner, who found that some who are very sensitive to, I believe it was sulfur, also, and or histamine, I believe, also tend to be hypersensitive, and perhaps even an overlap with those who have mast cell activation syndrome. She's commented, finds those individuals to also potentially be electrosensitive. So let's talk a little bit more about what that looks like and what people can do if they feel that to be them.
So, Mike, we know from study work that's been replicated quite a number of times throughout the world, actually, that more than 20% of us have some form of electrohypersensitivity. And so they would be, more than 20% would be characterized as electric hypersensitive. It's also true that if you're electrohypersensitive, you're multiply chemically sensitive. In other words, the chemical gases that you were talking about a minute ago, you're sensitive to. And there's very simple reasons why. A cell's a cell. It doesn't invent a way of dealing with one toxin that differs from another toxin. And so that's the starting point. 80% of that 20% are women on the average. So we know from study work that women seem to be more susceptible to men. And honestly, I haven't seen any justification of why. You know, I've heard some physicians speculate that it's the neurological composition, it's the hormones, it's this and that. But there's never really been any real evidence telling us why that's true. But it is from some of the large studies that I've looked at.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely a trend in that direction. Exactly, yeah. Why I think we're still trying to map out. And these individuals, I'm assuming they're somewhat commonly reporting. And actually, this is something I've noticed, that if I have a cell phone to my head for a minute or two, I do notice a sensation. It's light, but I do notice it.
Yeah.
So people are noticing that type of thing, where maybe if they hold the cell phone for too long, they notice a tingling in their hands or a warmness, yep, at their ear or something, yep, like this.
Yeah. And by the way, the numbers I quoted were actually from study work that was replicated a few different studies. I interact with clinics all the time, and it is their view that it's increasing. In other words, they have patients come into their office and they can't quite figure out what the sources are. It's like, I have a headache. And so take 2 aspirin and call me tomorrow. 2 aspirin doesn't help because they're looking at a monitor all day. And the source of the problem is the monitor they're looking at, not that they have a headache because of some other biological conditions.
Now, do you recommend that people use blue light screening or EMF reducing glasses during the daytime? I mean, I know at nighttime, sure, but I've seen more and more people wearing these Bluetooth blocking glasses during the day. And to me, that doesn't make any sense at all, because, arguably we want some blue light exposure during the day.
So this is a great topic to talk about. All right. So to further the discussion I was just having about 2 aspirins because you have a headache, I was talking with one physician, and he was telling me how he had a teammate within his clinic that had dry eye, and it had gone on for 10 years. And I said, well, what was the source of the dry eye? Oh, we don't really know, but, we treat it with drops, and it wets the eye, and everything is good. And I said, do you realize blue light can create dry eye? And I actually sent him a pair of blue light blocking glasses. Mike, within 2 hours, her eyes cleared up and were now wet. Within 2 hours. Sure. And it was the monitor that she constantly looked at. So we know from actually study work that there's clear evidence that there's that linkage, at least with some of us. And we know that there's a linkage with premature macular degeneration. There's been study work that clearly states that there's that linkage. So we're learning a lot about the blue component of electromagnetic radiation. It's visible electromagnetic radiation, right? But you can see it. For everyone to understand, it's right next to the ultraviolet, right? Sure. Ultraviolet is why you get cancer, right? You go out in the sun, and if you don't put the sunscreen on, you run the risk of skin cancers. Well, the blue component is right next to the ultraviolet. So it's a strong signal. It's a wave of emissions. Mm-hmm. And we're learning more and more and more as time goes on that it's not just macular degeneration concern. It's not just a dry eye concern. They're seeing actually pathways to the pineal glands, and they're seeing degraded pineal performance under certain conditions. So we know that this electronics that we're constantly staring at can be potentially dangerous. Now, let's talk about the use of blue light blocking glasses. At night, when you're planning to go to bed within 2 hours of going to bed, if you need to look at a monitor, you definitely should be looking at blue light blocking glasses. And the question is, why? Well, natural light, since the dawn of man, has been how our circadian rhythm is controlled. And all of a sudden, we have a high-intensity LED signal going into our eye at night, and it looks like it's still day. So the cryptochrome protein, which is the switch that turns the melatonin on and off, is not kicking in. And so you decide after 2 hours you want to go to sleep, but you can't. And the reason is directly linked, in some cases anyway, that you've hindered melatonin creation that naturally builds up when it gets darker within your environment.
Sure.
And so the need to shield becomes even more true if you're hypersensitive, electro-hypersensitive, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people who are or tend to be, rather than looking at 100% blue light blocking glasses during the day, they may want to consider the 50% or something around 50%, because they tend to be more sensitive than the average. So in general, it's not a bad idea, particularly if you have a slight sensitivity to it, to begin shielding yourself from during the day. Because at that point, the blue component of natural light tends to disrupt biological function.
And I'm assuming you also endorse the use of screening, you know, computer programs. I use a program called Iris that filters out blue light and flicker. Would you be behind something like that also?
Mike, you don't need blue light blocking glasses if you do that, right? Because they're actually taking the component out, the blue component out of the, yeah, absolutely. You do not need to buy them if you have technology devices that you actually can control it. You're right.
Mm. Yeah, it's funny you say this, because, and this could be me kind of retrospectively pulling a confirmation bias here, but over the past maybe 2 years, I have been using a blue light filtering program on my computer, and I have noticed my ability to work at the computer without becoming fatigued has gone way up. Now, I've also gotten healthier during that time. I've dialed in a few things for my gut health. I'm sleeping more. I'm taking more breaks. Yep. So I can't say it's just that, but it is interesting to notice that definitely that feeling of eye fatigue, again, whether that's from sleep, more breaks and gut health, or from the screening device, is hard to say, but definitely that feeling of eye fatigue and eye strain has gone down quite a bit.
Yeah, Mike, the point about fatigue we talked about, you're becoming fatigued because of the blue light component of
the stimulation the
spectrum. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so by doing it, you reduce the number of potential variables in the equation, essentially, and that's what you're trying to do. Taking the best action you can to minimize the potential dangers to your body from the technology.
Sure.
Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Ruscio. In case you need help, I wanted to quickly make you aware of what resources are available to you. If you go to drruscio.com/resources, you will see a few links you can click through for more. Firstly, there is the clinic, which I'm immensely proud of, the fact that we deliver cost-effective, simple, but highly efficacious functional medicine. There's also my book, Healthy Good, Healthy You, which has been proven to allow those who've been unable to improve their health, even after seeing numerous doctors, to be able to help them finally feel better. There's also our store, where there's a number of products like our Elemental Heal line, our probiotic line, and other gut supportive and health supportive supplements. Health coaching. We now offer health coaching, so if you've read the book or listened to a podcast like this one, or are reading about a product and you need some help with how or when to use or how to integrate with diet, we now offer health coaching to help you along your way. And then finally, if you're a clinician, there is our clinician's newsletter, The Future of Functional Medicine Review, which I'm very proud to say we've now had doctors who've read that newsletter find challenging cases in their practices, apply what we teach in the newsletter, and be able to help these patients who were otherwise considered challenging cases. Everything for these resources can be accessed through drruscio.com/resources. Alrighty, back to the show.
How do you feel about testing devices? I have one. I have found it to be helpful. Just to share for the audience, I think I've mentioned this before, but I have my Wi-Fi router, and clearly the closer to that I get, the more signal I'll see on the device. And I've done a few assessments, like with the Bluetooth mouse. So it has been helpful for me. The thing that concerns me is there's these different facets of, you know, EMF and microwave and Bluetooth, and I'm not sure if I know enough about the different lengths and what device picks up a given length. And so for me, I said, well, let me get one general meter and I'll do the best that I can. What are your thoughts? Is there a good meter for doing this, or should people just kind of assume that these devices are a problem and just try to mitigate without necessarily getting a specific reading?
Right, Mike. That's the latter is what I sort of hang my hat on. And the reason why is because so many people that we deal with buy these pieces of technology and they really don't understand what they're doing with it. And they begin panicking if they're in a microvolt measurement when they should be in a volt measurement. So there's a lot of concern from the use of those devices, which is inappropriate. The other thing, I when I used to run technical laboratories, we had calibration as a critical part of what we did. Calibration of technology or the testing equipment we use is pretty critical. What I know for sure is a lot of the devices we see are often almost orders of magnitude off. So here you're looking at something panicking, and it's really no danger to you. So you have the potential of looking at something and being misinformed because of the inaccuracy of the technology. Mm-hmm. So in general, what you said, Mike, is the best coaching you can have. Try to think where there may be problems and try to figure out how to minimize those problems. And you know what? Most of the time, you're really going to fix all problems. If you go Ethernet throughout your house, for example, if you create the sanctuary in your bedroom where you eliminate all the transmitting devices that could potentially be harmful for you, taking those kinds of actions are far more effective at trying to create a safe environment for you in your home.
Sure. So. Sure. Well, I feel like there's a lot more here we could explore. We may have to do a part two. Is there any closing advice you'd like to leave people with? And then please do tell people. I know you've written a book. You have a website, a number of products. Please do tell people about where they can learn more from you and your good work also.
Yeah, we have defendershield.com. And we have the book, Radiation Nation, that we wrote, which is essentially we capture what research has over the past 30 years understood about the exposures we have in our lives and the things you can do about it that maybe can mitigate some of the potential. And so Radiation Nation gives you that. We also have a learning section. Mike, I have a section there that we have 5-10 pages simply helping you understand what 5G is about. You know, these recent days, there's a bunch of panic going on about this fifth generation technology. And it's because they don't have somewhat all the facts. The facts will help you understand if you're in danger or not. And so we try to offer the latest in information from around the world that can help you understand those things. And of course, if you're thinking about using your laptop or your cell phone to your head, the reason I invented the shielding for that was because I wasn't going to throw my technology away, Mike. I want to use my cell phone, but I would never put it to my head until I had shielding that would protect me. So we have a variety of those kinds of technologies available. If you choose to shield yourself, we try to offer as many different ways of doing that so you find protection. One of the things we didn't talk about much today at all is over the last 5 years or so, what used to be referred to as oxidative stress and I'm sure you have a background with oxidative stress. Most people think that the imbalance with the free radicals and the antioxidants characterizes the stress, oxidative stress, and all of a sudden everyone understands oxidative stress. Well, I hate oxidative stress because it does not characterize what the body's doing. I think that the work that Navio is doing, Dr. Navio out of California, is CDR, cell danger response, which is an evolutionary conservative cellular metabolic response from a toxin. And so we're really starting, science is really beginning to understand what is the impact to our body, and now is better explaining the complexity of the body in response to the electromagnetic radiation in our environment today. So I would encourage particularly the medical community to consider looking into what is CDR, because it is a very, to me, very eye-opening. And it was the detail I needed to see that explained why a cell is a cell, why a cell doesn't respond differently to the gases in the air versus an emission next to your head from a laptop.
And does this tie in with the magnesium channels and how this, I guess, affects?
There's all sorts of stuff. It's like really exciting. You know how if there's a bear in the room, you're going to decide to fight or you're going to run, right? Fight or flight. Well, the body does that. The cell does that, believe it or not. And so when it gets into those kinds of states, it prevents simple, normal biological response of a cell. And there's the communication between the cells. There's all sorts of things that occur when these kinds of cell responses are occurring because of the electronics around us. And I suggest that anybody in the medical community should be looking at having a slightly better understanding, a more modern understanding of what these technologies are doing to us. And I see Dr. Navio's work is one of those places in which she's doing wonderful work, in my opinion.
Well, you've given us a topic to potentially explore and unpack in a subsequent podcast.
Yeah, right. I'm excited about that work because for years I was working with a biochemist, and I kept on telling her a cell doesn't respond differently. The body is responding from a historical perspective from years and years of response to the environment. And now we have introduced something new, and that body is responding as it has for hundreds and thousands of years. And it just turns out it hasn't figured out how to do it very well with electromagnetic radiation because it's only been around 10 years.
Sure. Well, I've made a note about that, and it's something I think we'll pick up. It's always a never-ending pursuit here to provide people with the best information. And speaking of, I really appreciate your balanced approach that you take to this. Some of the narratives I've heard on EMF have been a little bit absolutist and over the top. I really appreciate the nice kind of middle ground that you reasonably navigate. So just really appreciate the time, Dan. And thanks for the book and the products that you've made. I actually just bought in your store while we were talking a EMF blocking armband because I don't have one. And so that's one more layer of protection I will now be adding to my routine.
Very good, Mike. Thanks an awful lot for inviting me. I really did enjoy chatting with you today.
Absolutely. Been a pleasure.
And I do think we have other things to chat about as well that may be interesting to your listening audience.
Yep. I'm making a note of it now. All right, Dan. Thanks again, buddy. Appreciate
Mike,
it.
Mike, thanks so much.
Bye. You're welcome.
Bye. Have a good one.
Thanks for listening to Dr. Ruscio Radio today. Check us out on iTunes and leave a review. Visit drruscio.com to ask a question for an upcoming podcast, post comments for today's show, and sign up to receive weekly updates. That's drruscio.com.